You're listening to Counterculture on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio. You are with Marie and joining me now is Santici Collins. Santici is Māori, Filipino and European descent, and she's the current acting director of ECPAT New Zealand, an organisation dedicated to upholding the fundamental rights of children in Aotearoa New Zealand, ensuring they're free from all forms of sexual exploitation and trafficking. As the first child trafficking survivor to lead the organisation, Santici feels immensely privileged to champion the rights of victim survivors and to ensure their needs are central to the development and the delivery of the organisation's programmes. As a member of the Global Network of Survivor Leaders, she actively collaborates to the creation of safe spaces where victim survivors can contribute to the design of the response, reintegration and recovery services, alongside meaningful participation and research. That's a very long introduction, but I wanted to do it, Santici, because there is so much good work that you're doing. Good morning and welcome to Counterculture. How are you?
Atamari, Marie. Thank you. I realised as you were saying my bio that it was quite a mouthful, so I apologise when it's out loud.
It's great because it actually, a lot of our questions are going to come from that bio, and this is a place here in Counterculture. We talk about a lot of these issues. We're one of the few places in media in this country that does. Obviously, as it hinted in that bio, you are the first survivor to head this organisation. So tell us a little bit more about your story.
Sure. So it's really not been a linear one. I think most survivors' stories aren't linear. And really, I guess we could be here all day. So rather than telling a whole story about how I got to this point, I will just say how I got to ECPAT. So when I moved through my recovery and I was really in a position to advocate, because my background is in human rights, my academic background, I have a master's in human rights. And so I really felt like I wanted to use my voice and my academic background and professional background in this field to really champion change in the sector. And so I started out just volunteering with ECPAT. And then after that, I became an anti-trafficking advocate for ECPAT while I was doing my master's. And after that, I became a governance board member, and now I've transitioned into the role of acting director. And so being able to use my lived experience in this way is really, really quite a new thing in this space. There aren't a lot of public survivors that are out there advocating. And it's taken me some time to get to this point because I was a public servant for many years. And as I'm sure you know, you cannot be outwardly challenging the government when you're a public servant. So, yeah, it's been a labor of love, but I'm happy to be here and in a position to make change.
So what does ECPAT look like as an organization in New Zealand? So what sort of size and scale do you have and some of the work that you do here on the ground currently?
So we're really quite a small organization relative to our counterparts overseas. We are part of the ECPAT International Network, which is made up of over 120 countries in the network. Relative to many of our counterparts, we obviously don't have as many resources, and I think that comes down to the fact that trafficking is not really acknowledged to the extent that it needs to be in Aotearoa, and so therefore we don't get government funding. We rely heavily on the goodness of philanthropists and community organizations to keep our work going. And so the programs that we have in place is we train frontline workers, and we also offer a community of practice to those frontline workers who want to get involved and still collaborate and share trends. We are also piloting the Young Survivor Engagement Project, and that's in South Auckland. And so that is for rangatahi aged 17 to 24, I believe, maybe 16, depending on their position in their recovery or in their place in life. And basically, they have experienced some form of sexual exploitation, which has hindered their ability to thrive. And so we're working with them to try and see what post-traumatic growth looks like and help them recover and reintegrate properly. So that's one of the projects as well that we have going on. We also have the Helpline campaign, which I'm the face of, and I believe there will be promotional links if anyone wants to have access to that. Gosh, I feel like I'm just rattling off a lot of things we do with such a small team.
No, not at all. It sounds like for a very small team, you're doing a tremendous amount of work. But just for our listeners, let's try and put some context around this. What is the scale of child exploitation and trafficking in New Zealand?
Sure. So it is greater than we realise. However, I want to clarify that we do not actually have the stats. So I know that I've heard from different interviews that there are stats that are shared, and typically those stats, from my understanding, are usually based off of, say, Australian numbers or globally what's going on. And I don't think that creates an accurate picture of what's going on here. So first of all, our understanding of human trafficking, exploitation, and modern slavery is very much based on movies, TV, and media, in my opinion, and really what I'm seeing on the ground as well. And so that really conflates the issue with what's going on overseas, first and foremost. So if we're going to contextualize it and look at what's happening right here in our own backyard, what we are seeing is certainly not the same scale as countries that have much larger populations. To give you some stats that we do know, and so these are really recent stats of human trafficking allegations, including labor exploitation and sex trafficking. So from June of last year to May of this year, we had 1,097 allegations of trafficking. And so that went to Immigration New Zealand and was often dealt with through the Labour Inspectorate. And then that has resulted in 378 investigations. So those stats I can tell you. The other stat that I can give you is that when we're getting reports of online exploitation, because we don't have a national referral mechanism, those stats, those referrals often come from the US because they do have a mechanism. They have the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and we get 200 referrals a month from the NCMEC to New Zealand. So that's transferred to our jurisdiction. Those are stats that I can stand by because I know of them.
So those 200, are they 200 missing children believed to possibly be trafficked through New Zealand?
Sure, yeah, I can understand how that would come across because of the name of the actual center, but no. So it's basically, we also get referrals of children that are in situations of some type of exploitation. They're not necessarily missing, but they are in some type of child exploitation, usually sexual exploitation, and so they are referred onto our jurisdiction. But, you know, 200 referrals a month, even if they're not missing children, relative to our population size, that's a lot, right?
Yeah, that is a lot of children. So then just clarify for me the difference between child exploitation and child trafficking.
Yeah, great question. You know, important for people to understand the distinction. I'm not going to cover all the legalities because that's boring, but I will clarify some key factors. So we often use trafficking and exploitation interchangeably, but it's more clearly defined as trafficking when there is some kind of transference. So I'll give you transference or transportation. Basically, the key factors in a classic trafficking case involve the transportation, harboring, and transference of a child, with the transactional component involving money, goods or services. That's what would be more clearly defined as trafficking broadly. However, in order for it to constitute sex trafficking, you can essentially go to, a child can go to another, a friend's house, as an example, and be exploited there by, you know, they can consent to going to their friend's house. and then be in a situation of exploitation. And when I say exploitation, I mean they are put in a position where they need to engage in a sexual activity in exchange for money, goods, services, or protection. You know, so we often commonly refer to this as survival sex, because you are a child is put in a position where they need to get their basic needs met through the vehicle of sexual activity, which we know is obviously not legal, not consensual, even if there is some perceived benefit for the child. That's why we use exploitation and trafficking interchangeably. And I know that sometimes it feels like semantics, but it usually comes down to small things like movement. And the reason why we have these perceptions of trafficking being just kidnapping and being taken away somewhere else is because people only think of it as being one type. I want to move us away from thinking of it like that. I want us to think of exploitation as a spectrum. And along that spectrum, we have labor, we have sexual exploitation, we have online exploitation. And there's an intersectionality between all of these factors, because the key factor is not movement, it is transaction. You are being, as a person, as a human being, you are being traded for something else. You are being sold for something else. And that's the key factor that people need to understand.
Thank you for that. That was an excellent explanation. So then that leads me to ask, what is the most common misconception of this by the general public? Because as you said, the public's idea of this is scoped by media and what they see on television, yet the reality on the ground could be something quite different. So what are the common themes that you come up against again and again?
Sure, because people think that you need to have, you know, you need to be abducted, right? First, that's typically what the misconception that people come to me with. And I want to clarify that that is a very real thing too. You know, it affects average people. I'm one of them. But my experience, I wouldn't say is what I'm seeing in the sector and in the field. So my experience happened overseas, and then I subsequently experienced sexual exploitation in Aotearoa. And I can tell you that my experiences in both countries are vastly different. And I say that because here it's quite underground, I guess. And I believe you had Gloria Masters on the show, and she covered this a bit in terms of what it looks like and how it can happen in your own home. And that's so true, because it's often someone that is known to the child or the person. There's often an element of grooming. There are factors where trust is gained in order for a person to engage in sexual activity, and then sometimes forced criminality where they engage in illegal activity and get convictions. And so there's that snowball effect that happens. And so it's not a classic case of being taken away and then held for a time and sold. It's not a sensational experience that you would watch on TV. It could be, you know, quite benign. You may not know it's even happening in a back room somewhere during a party or something like that. I guess a clearer example that we are seeing in our research, and certainly, you know, with working with police and Oranga Tamariki that I know of, is that we are seeing rangatahi, young people who are in a position where they're unhoused for some reason, and they don't have another way to survive other than to obviously, you know, engage in sex. I mean, there's other ways to survive, but a common theme we're seeing is that they are engaging in sex so that they can have a warm home to stay in, to get food, just to feel clean and dry. And those are basic human rights, you know?
So then is poverty and a degradation of family values and culture but partly a driver for this? It's not actually allowing children to have a safe place at home, the most fundamental place that they should feel safe, it is then placing them in risk. Is that something that we're seeing in this country?
Yeah, I would definitely say that poverty is a driver. I mean, you could say that poverty is a driver for most crime, though, you know, so it's difficult to isolate what are these key factors. I do think that one of the things I'm seeing is some type of isolation of the child. So whether that's being unhoused or a disconnection from whānau, from friends, from their network, that makes them vulnerable to grooming and to people, I guess, preying on that vulnerability. Mm-hmm. So that's certainly something that we're seeing. And then from there, because they've obviously had that violation, that mistrust of people, it makes it really difficult for them to recover and reintegrate then and reconnect. So yeah, those are certainly other elements as well.
What does the grooming look like?
So grooming typically is understood as when an adult is engaging with a young person to try and build trust so that they can get something from that young person. That can take on many forms. They can first target parents or other friends to try and gain that trust. They can do that through compliments online. They can give them gifts. They can trauma bond with them so they can share their own experiences to make it seem like they're both going through the same struggles and they can be there for each other. So it's basically when you sort of triangulate, when you put a person in a position where they feel so enveloped in love and trust, and then the exploitation comes from that.
So one of the conversations I've often had, and I've spoken to a number of people that work in the space of porn particularly, there's a very fine line now between highly sexualized content that is acceptable and pornography, and where that line tips over, which then I guess if you're a young person experiencing that content, being able to identify what is promiscuous sexual behavior and abuse. Are you seeing a blurring there for kids, that kids are actually in abusive situations without actually realizing they're in abusive situations?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I know that a number of our contacts, our stakeholders, have certainly different views around this. And I think what's important is not to conflate the issues. What constitutes abuse and pornography is really difficult to detect because they're actors, of course. However, when it comes to children, we live in a generation where sexual norms are really changing as well. And I want to be careful, not because I'm, you know, sanitizing this, but I want to be clear that children are considering, you know, rangatahi, young people are considering OnlyFans as a legitimate profession and career. We're seeing this with social media influencers. And so the way they perceive their own bodies and sexuality is very different. And so they may be considering sex work at quite a young age. I'm not looking to conflate that in any form with exploitation, because those are two different things. There's an element of choice and agency when you want to consider sex work as your profession. And then there is exploitation where you don't have choice. You are put in a position where someone is actively making you go down a path that you know you probably don't want to go down, but your needs are being met.
But if grooming is very, very effective, the victims then wouldn't necessarily know that they don't want to go down that path. Wouldn't that be sometimes the case?
Yeah, yep, no, that's a very fair point. Yeah, if it's done by someone close to them already, then obviously it's really difficult to detect. I do know, though, that upon reflection, and I'm going to use my own experience here because I don't like to retell other survivor stories as well. I want them to have their own agency and share it in their own time. But for me personally, you can sense in your being that something is slightly off. You may not have the words to describe why this is wrong, But your intuition is a very powerful tool, right? And so upon reflection, I knew that what I was doing was not right, but it was someone that I trusted. And so it took time for me to reflect back and age and maturity, but I knew it wasn't right. While in the moment, it may be really difficult to see, certainly with time and being able to look at it through a different lens, you can see the difference between exploitation and really having a sense of agency.
Trust. You just mentioned yes. The trust with your own personal experience in terms of what you said before, that for most of these people, it's someone close to them that is the pathway into this abuse or trafficking. How do you then tackle people, either victims or families of victims, breaking those chains of trust within a family unit or a wider community space, for example? Because that's a very, very difficult thing for humans to do. We have trust to believe in those around us, but when that trust is broken, as an organisation, I guess you're there to pick up the pieces, but people need to get to you to be able to do that. That must be a massive barrier for getting help.
Yeah, and a big question as well. It's certainly not one that you can solve with every whānau. There's so many different dimensions. Or whānau, community, you know, friend network, these things happen within a broader social circles as well. And so I guess one of the things that I keep trying to share and promote is generally having braver conversations as well. So one thing that I try and communicate a lot is that people need to understand the difference between sexual violence as a whole and sexual exploitation. The reason why I feel like there needs to be that distinction and we need to have braver conversations around that is because when you are commodified as a person, it really changes your sense of self, your lens on the world, how you value yourself, especially if someone puts a monitoring, you know, a figure on your life's worth. And so that's what I feel we need to have as a society, as whānau. We need to just be a little bit more open. And I know that that may just start with someone that is a little bit more receptive and then build from there. You can't obviously go in and try and just share this with everyone because you're likely to get shut down. But start with a friend. Start with someone who you feel is confident, who can advocate for you if you're not ready, or, you know, in solidarity and kotahitanga, come with you to another person, another trusted person, and kind of build that momentum from there.
And that's, I guess, where APAC comes in, isn't it? Because you are a place landing for people that if they've reached out to someone within their own network that they can go to. A survivor comes to you or someone comes to you, there's concerns around exploitation or abuse. What then happens once they've reached out to you?
Sure. So we do operate an advice line. We're not a crisis line. Unfortunately, with such a small team, we're not equipped to handle that, and we don't have a dedicated national helpline either. So, you know, we would be struggling to deal with the calls if we were a crisis line. So as an advice line, basically parents, members of the community, sometimes young people themselves come to us to get advice on whether their situation is exploitation. Just to clarify, they might not have the language to summarize what they are experiencing as well, if they need to speak to police or rangatiriki and make a report of concern. And so we give guidance on things that they can say, ways that they can make a report where we're minimizing the re-traumatization, basically, because it can be a long journey of having to retell your story. So we're trying to minimize that for a young person in particular. We will, to the best of our ability, work with people to make a report if they're ready. If all they want is to access therapeutic services, so you know, some people never want to report. They just want to heal. They want to move on with their lives, which I absolutely respect. And so something that I can do, because I've been through it myself with making an ACC sensitive claim, is help them through that process a bit. When you make an ACC sensitive claim, you can be given, you know, years and years of therapeutic support and other varied types of support, including rongoā Māori as well. And so we will help guide them through that process, because that's not available. Help them access pro bono legal support as well, you know, different avenues like that in absence of having a national helpline.
You mentioned before about minimalizing trauma. The difficulty, of course, with that in terms of telling their story is that if there needs to be a legal component or an intervention there, or it warrants that situation, and I mean, I'm not wanting to minimise, I'm sure every situation in a perfect context will warrant it, but what's the difficulty for victims to take that step if they were wanting to get the police involved? From what I've spoken to other survivors, that's almost like a re-victimisation all over again, that process. What's been your experience? You mentioned a positive experience with the police earlier. So if people went down that legal path in terms of wanting to explore that, how does that look like in its current form? And is it fit for purpose?
That's challenging because our laws currently aren't fit for purpose. So we've been working quite hard to advocate behind the scenes for amendments to Section 98D of the Crimes Act, and often sex trafficking or sexual exploitation is prosecuted under the Prostitution Reform Act. And so, again, sorry, too legally.
No, you can be as legally as you like, you know, because there will be people that will understand that. So there is actually a little nub there from a legal perspective, from a statute perspective, there are some issues.
There are issues, yeah. And so the threshold for prosecution and, you know, evidential sufficiency is quite high. So for the definition of child trafficking, it requires evidence of deception and coercion. How do you get that without traumatizing a child? I'm going to be perfectly honest here. That seems really unreasonable to me, that you need to have those elements to prove it when a child is involved. And it's definitely misaligned with international best practice and international legal conventions. So what I'm saying is that if you take those steps, yes, it may very well result in a prosecution, and there may be some compensation on the other side. But will it be justice? What are you seeking when you report, when the system is not yet fit for purpose? That's what I say, is I'm not deterring a person from taking that avenue if they want their day to be in court, to be part of the proceedings, not necessarily be in court and face the offender, but, you know, be part of those proceedings that lead to some sense of justice. I'm not deterring a person from doing that. What I am saying, though, is that I don't necessarily think that that is a way to get justice in a system that is broken. I think that if you take those steps, we will obviously get data and we'll highlight that there is an issue and that there's likely to be services put in place as a result of it. But I'm always mindful that this will take a toll, you know, in the process. There's a personal cost of seeking justice, and you're not necessarily healing in that process either, because it's like picking at a scab or pouring salt in an open wound if it's just freshly happened. So what are you prepared to give to this process, knowing that you still have to go through the recovery part next?
I spoke to a dad who was the father of one of the survivors from the Jazz Brothers case. Now, the adults, obviously, but what was incredible speaking to him was how much protection as offenders they received through the entire process, how long that process was, how they were able to continue on with their lives while their victims were just left hurting. And also the level of organisation complexity and sharing are much around a wider group outside of just those brothers that didn't go through the legal process was going on. Is there elements like that in an adult context happening with children? So not just individuals working maybe in a smaller environment, a home or a smaller community environment, but is there a more organised crime element happening, victimising children in this country, to your knowledge?
Yes, there is, unfortunately. So we have, I should have clarified earlier, but we have a range of cases. So we have cross-border cases and allegations that do have that organised crime element. You know, we've certainly even heard instances of gangs, unfortunately, being involved. So there's a range of factors. We also, I want to stress too that I'm not looking to demonize this closed community. I want to highlight, especially with recent media, that Gloria Vale is also an example of both child labor and sexual exploitation as well. And so you could argue that there is a more organized element of that too. But if we're looking at organized crime, there's definitely links and money laundering and a range of issues, because this is a broader global industry, you know. And while we're relatively geographically isolated out in the Pacific Ocean, with globalization and increasing travel across borders, you know, it makes us more interconnected.
And also to the internet. I mean, that exploitation, I mean, all you require is a camera and an internet connection, isn't it? And
absolutely,
exploitation.
Yeah, and that's where we have those hybrid examples where it might start out as abuse in person, and then someone sees the opportunity to capitalize on it by live streaming it, and that's where in exchange for money, and that's where the exploitation happens, and it transitions into a hybrid situation.
As family and community, what are some of the things that we can look out for? The little red flags that you just sort of, maybe your spidey sense goes up. You're not 100% certain, but you just need to be a little bit more mindful about in terms of protecting your family, protecting your children. Basic stranger danger, for example, because I'm old, and when I was a kid, you know, we were taught stranger danger and very clear boundaries of things to be careful of. I worry now that a lot of those kids aren't being taught that now, because a lot of those barriers have been broken down and disintegrated. So how do we help galvanize our children to recognize places of danger to be able to protect themselves? Or if we see something within our own communities and we think, oh, no, surely not, or maybe, how do we identify it, get help to potentially investigate further, but without getting the wrong end of the stick, for example? So, you know, seeing zebras when they're actually just horses. So how do, as a society, do we become more vigilant in helping identify and protect these kids?
Great question, Marie. And I'll give you two examples, since there's obviously real world examples and then online. So one thing you can do in real world, say if you're a parent or you're just a concerned person, you're seeing something that's not quite right. So an example that I've come across recently, and I gave the same explanation, is that just look at the patterns and habits of a child. So if, say, you've got a child who maybe is from a lower socioeconomic background, and they are dressed a certain way, they present a certain way, but then there's a sudden change and they start dressing in more expensive clothes. They go to school with more expensive clothes. They talk about how they got a new PlayStation or TV or something like that. And they're suddenly taking trips away to places with a family friend, you know, who's given them these items or clothing. You know, those are sort of things where I would be wondering about that sudden change. And so I'm thinking about this over the course of time. So if this child has been historically dressing or carrying themselves in a certain way, and then there's just a sudden change when a family friend, as an example, comes into their life, then it doesn't hurt to query that, you know, just inquire about what's happened. Has, you know, it could just be innocent. Maybe someone's just come back from overseas and wants to shower their godchild with goods, but it could be something else as well. So we just want to exercise some sort of sensitive inquiry around that. You know, be a little bit considerate about how you ask those questions so it's not invasive, but you take an interest. So that's an example in the real world of what you can look out for. When you're online, there's a number of free tools now. I do it myself so I can avoid getting catfish. So I've used it firsthand. But you can actually use reverse image search tools. I don't know if you've ever used one, Marie.
No, I haven't. So where would you find such a tool?
Yeah, so you just Google reverse image search, like free reverse image search, and these tools will pop up. And what you can do is you can take a screenshot or you can copy a photo of the first person you've been talking to online, and you can, as it sounds, reverse image search. You can find out where that originally came from, and often what will pop up is all of the catfish, all of the people that have used that photo illegally. Sometimes it comes up with nothing, so it might be a real person that you're speaking with, but often you'll get the profiles of where this photo has been used.
So, for example, it will be a stock photo from a photo library. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, it could be a stock photo, or they could have taken it from someone else's profile and somewhere else in the world who's already uploaded their own videos and stuff on Instagram. And so they're basically catfishing. They're behaving as another person.
There are so many hooks in this. You know, it's quite incredible. I know Gloria does a lot of work around the hand signal, particularly for younger children. Getting that education out there to allow them to communicate to teachers and people in a school environment or a care environment that there is concern. I guess that's the other place too, is allowing and making sure that those people having access to our children, our educators, are actually up to play to identify some markers of where there could be signals for abuse at home. Is there work going on in that space in education to help our teachers to help identify and, you know, look out for these things for our kids?
Yeah, certainly for online exploitation, more and more education and awareness is happening, certainly through the likes of NetSafe and Network for Learning and similar organizations. So there is that work being done, but the reach isn't necessarily there. I wouldn't say that there's that reach into rural or sort of isolated communities just yet. And so that's something to be mindful of, is that if you are in a smaller community where maybe programs are not funded or resourced to get to you for whatever reason, that I would be a little bit more vigilant, because you may not have access to that knowledge, or maybe Wi-Fi is not, you know, fully set up to a certain level in certain areas, and then that could change, and so you might need that education. So I guess I would just be mindful of what's out there online to access, like videos and things like that, where there are no dedicated programs in schools.
Yeah. Now, finally, before we go, the Royal Commission of Inquiry into Abuse in Government and Faith-Based Care has been tabled now in Parliament. Now, I know you weren't directly involved with that, but have you had any thoughts, or what have you heard in your space around this inquiry, and what do you hope may be achieved from it?
So, as I mentioned before, with that transactional element that constitutes exploitation, I have certainly heard from partner organisations that have been involved in the Royal Commission of Inquiry that there has been that element. I mean, certainly the volume of abuse that's happened in state care and faith-based care, that's, you know, concerning enough. And as you said, you know, the inquiry is basically a doorstop. It's huge. And so it's really difficult to separate out cases where there was exploitation to understand the scale that was happening in state care. That's certainly something that I want to focus my attentions on, and also youth justice facilities as well. But I'm mindful that with the redress scheme that's being developed, that it's, you know, I feel like I'm pouring more fuel on the fire by highlighting cases of exploitation as well, you know, to an already huge inquiry.
Yeah. So if anyone's heard this today and they think, well, we want to reach out either to help, or we've got concerns around someone we know, or they may be a victim themselves, how do they contact ECPAT New Zealand or reach out for help?
Sure. So the easiest way is to visit our website, ecpat.org.nz. The link should be available as well, not only to our main website, but to our campaign to get involved. So if they just need access to the advice line, the numbers are on our website. If you do want to exercise your civil and political rights to make a change, you can help us advocate for a dedicated helpline. We have never in the history of Aotearoa had a helpline just for trafficking and exploitation. And I think it would be a really important next step. It would help the government understand the need and get us more data around these issues as well. So please, if you can, sign the petition, or at least just read it and get more information and see if it's something you want to be involved in some way. Yeah, every little bit helps.
Oh, look, Sintechi, it's been absolutely fascinating to talk to you this morning. This has been Sintechi Collins, the Acting Director of ECPAT New Zealand here on Counterculture. Thank you so much for your time, and I really do appreciate all this information. It's been so enlightening. So thank you so much, and go well and good luck.
Oh, you too, Marie. Thank you so much for your time. Have a great day. Kia pai tora.
Kia ora. And don't disappear. There is also more here to come with Counterculture on Reality Check Radio. Marty is up here shortly.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.